This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Speaking ill of the dead is a bit like that advert for a certain type of outdoor paint. The one that tells you that it does exactly, I think you probably know the one I mean, but it's so intensely irritating, I don't want to repeat the punchline. In this series, a number of distinguished historians will speak ill of the dead. Their brief was to choose a figure from Irish history, though that figure did not necessarily have to be Irish-born themselves, who had A, incurred their displeasure, and B, was deceased. They were then asked to deliver their philippics to an audience in the National Museum last March. If the overgenerous praise of a biographical subject can be characterised as a variation of hagiography, then speaking ill of the dead could probably be called counter-hagiography. Among the victims chosen were the likes of Edward Carson, Countess Markievicz, Sean McBride, Arthur Balfour, Kevin O'Higgins and William Gladstone. In other words, iconic but controversial figures about whom there are many differences of opinion. Like all good notions, the idea behind speaking ill of the dead was stolen. In this case, the victims were the Montana Historical Association in the USA. Each year at their annual conference, for most of the last two decades, a number of less than entirely serious papers were delivered under the heading Speaking Ill of the Dead, Jerks in Montana History. In most cases, the subjects chosen by Montana's historians were rather more unambiguously vile than those selected by their Irish counterparts. The idea was dreamed up by a Montanan named Dave Walter, who sadly himself died in July 2006. We trust that he's gone to a far better place than those appalling individuals whose pasts he and others have been raking over for the edification of Montana Historical Association delegates. And we hope that this series serves as a memorial for Dave. As RTE and the National Museum were going to blatantly rip off his idea in our own conference last March, we invited Dave Walter to attend and to speak. He was unable to make the trip, but he did record a virtual address on DVD, which was thoroughly enjoyed by our own audience. To introduce the whole concept, we're going to hear from Dave Walter now on how the idea caught on and on some of the more outrageous delinquents to have been highlighted over the years. It's worth bearing in mind, by the way, when he gets to the first female jerk in his litany, Mary Glyme, that the brothel keeper in question bore the maiden name of Mary Gleeson, and she hailed from the old sod itself. Makes you proud to be Irish.
When we began, there were no rules to define who qualified as a jerk, so people immediately nominated their spouses. Everyone nominated his boss, and in group nominations, kids got together to nominate their parents. Thus, we had to institute one rule, and it remains the only criterion for the jerk's designation. The nominee must be dead. This restriction also has proved helpful in fighting the inevitable slander and libel suits that have developed. In 1989, I was sitting on the reference desk in the Montana Historical Society Library. This sounds like a deadly job, but it was really the best position in the outfit, because it fielded all of the Montana history questions that came into the society, whether by mail or by phone or from walk-in traffic or from the staff. I could go home at the end of the day having learned two or three things about Montana history that I didn't know when I got there in the morning, and there just aren't many good jobs like that around. As we moved into 1989, it quickly became clear that the state centennial had prompted a good deal of interest among out-of-state researchers in their Montana ancestors. The calls and the letters went something like this. Dear Sir, my great-grandfather came to Montana in the 1890s, and I think he was the governor. Or, Uncle Fred and Aunt Maud arrived in Butte in 1903. The family thinks he was a copper king and maybe a U.S. senator, too. Apparently, no one's ancestor ever had been a clerk in a store, or a sheep herder, or a homestead wife, or a farmer, or a railroad worker, or, God forbid, a criminal. The conclusion that one draws is pretty obvious. When looking at our past, we do tend to focus on what are the greatest, what are the best, and what are the most wonderful things. The trouble with this approach to history is that it's one-sided. It sanitizes our history. Perhaps to me the greatest sin, it takes the humor out of our history, It portrays a past that never was. The real past included real people like us, people who were a mixture of good and bad. Montana has been the home of some reprehensible characters who were involved in some abhorrent activities, and they deserve equal time. For example, Toussaint Charbonneau. This French trapper trader joined the Lewis and Clark expedition in 1805 at the Mandan villages after shamelessly promoting himself as an all-purpose outdoorsman and a highly skilled interpreter. The captains hired him only because his young wife, Sacagawea, was a Shoshone. Charbonneau distinguished himself by offering the sexual services of his wives for a bit of cash, by swamping one of the pirogues, losing valuable supplies, and by abandoning George Drouillard in the face of a grizzly attack. He fed Sacagawea strange raw white apples, making her very ill, and he struck her, for which he was reprimanded by Captain Clark. Lewis summarizes Charbonneau by noting that he was, quote, a man of no particular merit, end quote. Why be so obtuse? Toussaint Charbonneau was a wife-beating jerk. Or, the Reverend Leonard Chrysler, an Episcopalian minister from Havre, late teens, early 20s, Reverend Chrysler was responsible for building several of the Episcopal churches that are still existing along the High Line. He was young, handsome, dynamic, a great speaker who filled the church primarily with female parishioners. He was such a good speaker that he joined a Chautauqua company in the summer, working out of the Midwest. Chautauqua was a traveling show that brought quality drama and music and oration to small towns. It was called Culture Under Canvas. After the second summer on the Chautauqua circuit, Reverend Chrysler returned to Havre with a songstress whom he'd met on the road and deposited her in the spare bedroom of the rectory. Mrs. Reverend Leonard Chrysler accepted this arrangement for 2 whole days before she shot them both dead in the parlor and never was charged with anything. So evidently that's acceptable behavior in Havre. The Reverend Leonard Chrysler is a jerk. Or, Ike Gravel, Montana's first Unabomber. In 1903, Ike held Montana hostage in an attempt to extort $25,000 from the Northern Pacific Railroad. He blew up NP bridges and tunnels and mainline track. He froze the Northern Pacific's passenger traffic during the summer of 1903. Ike was finally caught through his own lack of education. He began to write his own extortion letters, and Ike couldn't spell. Ike died in the basement of the governor's mansion in Helena by his own hand, surrounded by a posse. Ike Gravel is a jerk. A group nomination for the Carlin Hunting Party, three Eastern hunters who in October of 1893 dropped into the Lacsaw Valley right over the hill from Missoula. They took with them an outfitter guide and a camp tender cook, a man by the name of George Colgate. They went in late in the season. Winter weather came early. What was rain down in the bottom of the canyon was snow up on the Lolo Trail. Colgate became ill. He had neglected to bring his catheters with him, and he began to fill up with poisonous fluids. The outfitter pleads with the Eastern hunters to get Colgate on a horse and get him out of there while they still can, but the Eastern hunter says, "Oh, the elk hunting is so good here. Let's just stay a few more days." And days turn into weeks. Finally, they get Colgate, now immobile, up on a horse, and they climb the 3,000 feet to the Lolo Trail, where they find 6 feet of snow and they can't get out. So they drop back into the valley, let the horses go, and spend 2 weeks building 2 rafts to float out the Lacsaw. The Lacsaw is known as a river with huge boulders in it. The rafts are finally in the water with a delirious Colgate aboard. They make it about 10 miles before the rafts break up on the rocks and the ice. So the intrepid hunters go into council. As a result, they decide to prop Colgate up against a tree, still alive, and hike out to save their own skins. A group nomination for the Carlin Hunting Party. You'll notice there are not many women on this list. a woman in Big Timber one evening suggested that that was a fair representation of the ratio of jerky women to jerky men in Montana history. That's not so. There are just as many jerky women, but they suffer from what women in general suffer from in Montana history. They aren't documented as well yet. I do have one very good one. Mary Gleim, a 5-foot-tall, 250-pound Missoula madam. She ran the Front Street Red Light District there from the 1890s until 1914. Mary had three of the best attorneys in Missoula on retainer because she was constantly in court, battling city government and defending herself in aggravated assault cases. Because Mary's solution to any personal confrontation was to pummel her opponent with her fists. In one case, this involved two Jesuit priests from whom she tried to tear the robes, saying that they did not deserve to wear them. Mary spent time in the state prison in Deer Lodge for dynamiting the home of one of her competitors. I got to know Mary when I was in graduate school in Missoula. Without reflecting too deeply on what it says about my character, I used to spend a lot of time wandering around cemeteries in Missoula. You can learn a lot of history in cemeteries. There's a place in the Missoula City Cemetery where all of the headstones are about 2 feet high and all of the inscriptions read the same way. The exception to this rule is about a 5 or 6 foot granite obelisk that sits toward the back of this pod of headstones, and it faces the other way. It says Gleim on it, and it faces a fence and a roadway and a railroad track. And I could never figure out this arrangement, how the cemetery people put this together. That it just didn't make any sense. It didn't look organized, and the dates didn't give any clue. Until one day I was in the Missoula County Courthouse when I ran across Mary Gleim's will. And in her will, she says, she puts aside $5,000 for the creation of the obelisk and says, indeed, that it should be turned around. It should face the railroad tracks because, quote, the railroad workers were some of my best customers, and I want them to be able to wave at me as they go back and forth to work every day. Mary Gleim is a delightful jerk. A group nomination for the Ku Klux Klan in Montana, 1923 to 1931, a widespread movement, better than 50 chapters, more than 52 dues-paying members in 1924. You got what you'd expect from the Klan. Extreme secrecy, hoods, torchlight parades, and lots of cross burnings for the purpose of intimidation. In at least one instance, the Montana KKK was involved in the killing of a black man at Crow Agency. Notable chapters in this area include chapter number 10 in Bozeman, number 16 in Missoula, number 19 in Great Falls, number 25 in Shoto, number 30 in Butte, number 31 in Deer Lodge, number 38 in Townsend, number 42 in Boulder, and two chapters in Helena. Helena was the only community that found it necessary to have two chapters, chapter number 11, the Helena chapter, and chapter number 32, the Capital chapter, Capital with a K. A group nomination for the Ku Klux Klan. Another woman, Vera Prosser, an attractive woman in her mid-20s who in June of 1910 was recently divorced in Seattle from her husband of 5 years. The ex-husband and two of his friends decide to make a business trip from Seattle cross-country to Ohio, so they get a compartment on a Great Northern train. Vera hears about this trip and gets on the same train. Vera is doing what we now call stalking. The train leaves Spokane, runs through northern Idaho, and drops into northwestern Montana. The two companions leave the compartment. Vera enters the compartment with her ex-husband. We don't know exactly what happens because they're the only two in there, but Vera pulls a small caliber revolver from her handbag and shoots her ex-husband in the temple. He falls on the floor of the compartment and is bleeding to death. The noise of the train muffles the shot. Then she does something that I don't understand. Women have tried to explain to me what's going on here, and I just seem to be too dense to get it. Vera takes the time, her husband dying on the floor of the compartment, to strip all of the clothes off of him and to push those out the window of the moving train. So when she leaves the compartment, she leaves a dying, naked ex-husband. The train gets to Libby, Vera gets off, the train goes on, the two companions come back to the compartment and find the dead body of their friend. They wire back to Libby and say, arrest Vera, she's killed her ex-husband. So Vera is arrested and held in Libby. But Lincoln County in 1910 is a brand new county, and it has no facilities for women in the county jail. So Vera is kept in the executive suite at the Libby Hotel at taxpayer expense. She eats her three meals a day in the hotel dining room off the menu at taxpayer expense. Each day a deputy sheriff comes to the hotel, picks Vera up, and to exercise they walk up and down Main Street. And she's young and attractive and personable, and Vera builds a real following in the Libby community. The people of Libby learn to like Vera so much that they elect her the mascot of the Libby Town baseball team. So when the team plays in town, the deputy sheriff comes to the hotel, picks Vera up, she goes out and cheers for her boys. When the team goes out of town, Vera goes with them. She made one trip as far as Columbia Falls and another trip as far as Missoula. Finally, there's a trial in August of 1910. Women do not sit on Montana juries at the time, so Vera draws a jury of 12 middle-aged ranchers and miners and loggers, each of whom is deeply in love with her. The trial lasts for 3 days. The jury is out for 6 minutes. Vera is found not guilty. She gets back on the Great Northern and returns to Seattle, a freed woman. And finally, Jacob Thorkelson. Thorkelson is a Butte physician from the 1920s and the 1930s. He attempted to start a nudist colony on the flat south of town. At 6,000 feet, this was not a successful business venture. Politically, Dr. Thorkelson was extremely conservative. Through several misadventures, he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives from Montana in 1938. So on the eve of World War II, what Montana has representing its people in Washington is a Nazi sympathizer. Thorkelson is the only person I can find in the history of the U.S. House whose colleagues restricted him from placing his comments in the congressional record. If you know the congressional record, you know that a congressman can get anything he wants in there, laudatory editorials, letters from his mother, even recipes. But Thorkelson could add nothing because his colleagues wouldn't let him. In 1940, Thorkelson was replaced by Jeanette Rankin, the only one in Congress to vote against U.S. entry into World War II, so you have a very nice contrast there. At this time, Thorkelson received an invitation for an audience with Hitler. And Thorkelson and his friends provide just a sampling of Montana jerks. There is an endless supply. These examples of jerks in Montana history remind us that history is not an exact science. This is not chemistry, it's not biology, it's not even geology. For most of the public, the best of Montana history remains much closer to the oral tradition, to the art of research storytelling, than we might want to admit. Without a doubt, this approach to Montana history has its detractors, people who feel that it is disrespectful, that it panders to our basest instincts. My wife is among this group. I counter only that if by looking at some Montana jerks we become more interested in our Montana past, that is justification enough for me. Of course this is all in fun because what we are doing here is using standards from the year 2006 to judge past behavior, and that constitutes an absolute travesty among historians. Historians maintain that we should strive to judge people in the context of their own times and their own situations. When you enroll in graduate school at Missoula or Bozeman in history, on the very first day they back you into a corner and make you swear that you'll never judge past events and people by today's standards. And it is your first day and you're scared to death, so you agree. But then as soon as you settle on a thesis topic, you throw that promise over your shoulder and you do what we all do. You judge past events by present criteria. In 1968, Bobby Kennedy was campaigning in a housing project on the south side of Chicago. Here he was introduced to a 10-year-old black girl who was all dressed up to meet him. She had on new black patent leather shoes and a brand new bright print dress. Her hair was in pigtails and her pigtails were in ribbons. Kennedy posed a question to her that he had used in similar situations during the campaign. He said, "If all the good things in the world were the color white and all the bad things in the world were the color black, what would you be?" And without a moment's hesitation, she looked him right in the eye and she said, "I'd be striped." Well, that's what looking at Montana's jerks is, a survey of some striped people from Montana's past, some Montana history zebras. I urge you to keep an eye out for jerks in your future reading, and I urge you, when you encounter them, to embrace them with gusto. Jerks are an important part of our past, and they deserve equal time. Thank you.
The late Dave Walter on the origins of speaking ill of the dead and on some of his particular favourites from the Montana Rogues Gallery. Now, of course, the concept has been franchised, if its extension to Ireland can be so described. Unlike the American mothership, in the Irish variation, which took place in the National Museum last March, the entire conference concerned speaking ill of the dead. In Montana, it provides some light relief from their annual Historical Association deliberations. About 200 people attended over the 2 days, and the exchanges were lively both from the podium and from the audience. Here's a sample of proceedings.
As we shall see, some very controversial people gave him the title saint. Even heretics. These people were so controversial that he was never formally canonized, because obviously popes are very wary of heretics, especially those who said the papacy was a farce, confession was a fraud, and transubstantiation was a con job. The person who said that was the person who said St. Richard Fitzrafe is one of the greatest clerics who ever lived. So you can see the kind of friends he had on his side.
Modern historical writers have tended to be a good deal more sceptical. Even Roy Jenkins, in a recent favourable biography, goes out of his way to make the point that Gladstone engaged in what we would call today insider trading. As a prime minister at a time of war fever and stocks falling, he knew, as prime minister, there was not going to be a war, and made some very shrewd investments, and then sold after the war fever had passed. Not illegal in those days, it would be illegal today.
We preached on every platform in the country that Ulster resisted Home Rule. If ever Home Rule were passed that included Ulster, rather than submit to it, Ulster would fight and Ulster would be right. I certainly preached that doctrine, and that doctrine I adhere to. But has anyone really grasped what it all means? It means that those who took this view were going to be as guilty technically of high treason as Casement himself.
McNally passed away in what was described as the odour of sanctity, hailed in nationalist circles as McNally the Incorruptible. Shortly after his death, it emerged that McNally had been for many years in receipt of a Secret Service pension of £300, bestowed on him as payment for information supplied by him on his friends, colleagues and clients. Sensationally, the man who had been acclaimed by Curran for, quote, his uncompromising and romantic fidelity over many years to Ireland, had turned out to have been for over 2 decades Dublin Castle's most important paid informer.
Marr outranked in Dublin the top-ranking Berlin diplomat, the ambassador, or as it was called, minister. The ambassador would have had to report to Marr for anybody because of the Nazi way of doing business. And Marr also was responsible for getting rid of 2 very senior men from Dublin. Both their sins was that they were Nazi enough.
In 1934, a group of Protestant workers from the Shankill Road decided to dip a toe into the Republican puddle. A lorry load of them travelled down to take part in the Republican rally at Bodenstown in memory of Wolfe Tone, whose ideal it was to reconcile Protestant, Catholic and dissenter. When the Protestant workers arrived at Bodenstown, they were ambushed by the Southern Republicans, beaten up and expelled from the graveyard. While I have discovered no written authorization from MacBride for this, there is little doubt that it could not have happened without his consent.
Long, along with Lord Lansdowne, the leader of the Conservative Party in the House of Lords, seized upon the inevitable gray areas to lead a wrecking campaign from inside the cabinet. Threatening to break up the coalition government, he was able to get the proposals amended to make partition permanent and to rebalance the deal in favor of Ulster Unionists. Redmond inevitably rejected this, and as Long and Lansdowne hoped, the deal fell through in July 1916. They didn't want to change the deal, they wanted to kill it.
Strongly pro-treaty, he was a tough Minister for Justice during the Civil War, responsible for the execution of over 70 Republican prisoners. He also established an Garda Síochána in 1923. And I'm not going to try and argue that he disliked all women or that he's a woman-hater. It's quite clear that he liked at least some women. He was married with a very young family at this stage, so presumably he liked and had a relationship with his wife. And he also was reputed to have been in love with Lady Hazel Lavery about this time.
Hysteria was whipped up in north-east Ulster. Carson denounced Home Rule on a platform as, quote, the most nefarious conspiracy that has ever been hatched against a free people. Privately, he wrote to Lady Londonderry, how I long to see Home Rule defeated. It is, I think, a passion with me. I cannot bear the hypocrisy of so-called political toleration.
The prosecutor at her court-martial, William Wiley, wrote a private memoir for his daughter more than 30 years later. I am only a woman. You cannot shoot a woman. You must not shoot a woman. She never stopped moaning the whole time she was in the courtroom. We were all slightly disgusted. She had been preaching rebellion to a lot of silly boys, death and glory, die for your country, etc. And yet she was literally crawling.
Some of the voices from the podium at the Speaking Ill of the Dead conference last March. You heard Terry Dolan on Richard Fitzrafe, Paul Bew on William Gladstone, Margaret O'Callaghan on Arthur Balfour, Tom Bartlett on 1798 informer Leonard McNally, Pat Wallace on Adolf Marr, David Narlis on Sean McBride, Peter Hart on Walter Long, Rosemary Cullen-Owens on Kevin O'Higgins, Martin Manzer on Edward Carson, and Ruth Dudley Edwards on Countess Markievicz. Next week, National Museum Director Pat Wallace kicks off our lecture series when he talks about one of his predecessors, Adolf Marr, an excellent museum director who also happened to be Ireland's number one Nazi. Until then, goodbye.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.